Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. Two 420-foot vertical speedways, three launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Measure that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 G's in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch strata coaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind from HowStuffWorks.com.
The thoughts of all men arise from the darkness. If you are the movement of your soul and the cause of that movement precedes you, then how could you ever call your thoughts your own? How could you be anything other than a slave to the darkness that comes before? Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick. And today's episode is mostly going to be an interview with the Canadian author R. Scott Baker, best known for his second apocalypse saga. Robert, how would you characterize that?
Well, I think that quote that I read there from his first book in the series, The Darkness That Comes Before, sums it up rather nicely. I was first turned on to the work of R. Scott Baker back in 2007, and I hadn't read anything quite like it at the time, and I really haven't read anything quite like his work since then. His first novel, The Darkness That Comes Before, casts the reader into a dark fantasy world and invokes the holy wars of our own world, Tolkien-esque evil, factional infighting worthy of Frank Herbert's Dune, and a deep philosophical core.
And we're actually going to be getting into not so much his science fiction and fantasy, but a recent philosophy paper of his. That sounds kind of odd, though we will discuss his science fiction and fantasy a fair amount. Don't worry about that if you're a fan. But we're really going to be focusing on R. Scott Baker's recent paper on alien philosophy, published this year in the Journal of Consciousness Studies. Yes, you heard that right. Alien philosophy. We will get back to that in just a little bit.
Yes, on alien philosophy, this is a wonderful thought experiment and sort of a reverse engineering of human philosophy via the consideration of a fictional convergian alien species and what sort of philosophical systems they might create to make sense of their own existence.
Yeah, so in the past, we've actually speculated about possible characteristics of alien life forms. We did this in that episode, Grizzly Bears from Outer Space. Do you remember that?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, like, would aliens have eyes? Would they have hands? How large are intelligent life forms generally? There was a paper back then that tried to use some statistical analysis to say, you know, it's really more likely, given certain planet sizes and gravity and stuff, that aliens are going to be pretty big. But this is always a tricky game, because if you are a reasonable person, you have to admit that if alien life exists somewhere out there, there's every chance that it could just totally defy your expectations. We don't always know what to expect. We can't be certain about much, but it is always fun to play the game. Okay, if we just start with a few fairly safe assumptions, what can we deduce about what types of life are possible? And one of those fairly safe assumptions is that whatever alien life exists, it's going to be the product of evolution by natural selection. I think it would be incredibly surprising if it turned out to not be the product of evolution by natural selection, meaning it's going to be a system that somehow encodes information, makes copies of itself through that information, and the copies survive and make their own copies at differential rates. And from these humble premises, you can actually start to make a lot of interesting guesses about what types of life are more possible or more common than others. And so we've already tried this with biological and ecological traits in the past. But in this new paper, R. Scott Baker chases this phenotype problem really deep. He goes on to guess, what are the philosophical projects that intelligent alien life forms would wonder about? What big questions would they share with us? What hang-ups are they really likely to dwell upon?
Yeah, it's a fascinating paper. And if you want to read it in full, I'll include a link to it on the landing page for this episode at stufftoblowyourmind.com. And I should also point out that the first six books in the Second Apocalypse Saga, including the first trilogy, are currently out there in just about any reading format you desire. And this summer, R. Scott Baker brings it all home. He's going to follow up last year's The Great Ordeal with The Unholy Consult, which is going to be out July 11th from Overlook Press. And if you're not ready to commit to a multi-book series, his standalone novels, Neuropath and Disciple of the Dog, are out there as well.
Though, Robert, I know you warned me about Neuropath.
Well, as we'll explore in the interview, Baker himself warns everybody about Neuropath, so be sure to tune in for that section of the conversation. Just a few quick notes about this episode. First up, this is a phone interview. We're in Atlanta, and Scott chatted with us from the wilds of Canada in the midst of a thunderstorm, so everything's not going to be necessarily as crisp as it usually is, but we think the content is definitely worth sticking around for. Secondly, I bring up a couple of details from the Second Apocalypse Saga that I think bear quick explanation. First, there's the Inkarai. Now, this is a hedonistic alien species that descends upon the world in ancient times. Undying, they're devoted to selfish indulgence, limitless pleasure, and a cataclysmic scheme to shield themselves from judgment. And then there are the non-men. This is an all-male race of humanoids that essentially serve as the waning elder race, the elves of Baker's world, only far darker and interestingly inhuman in many respects, both in body and in mind. And finally, there's a tiny bit of cursing in this episode, but it's polite Canadian cursing, and we bleeped it all out for you.
All right. Well, I'd say without further delay, maybe we should get into our conversation with R. Scott Baker.
Hey, Scott, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. Thanks for taking time out of your day to talk with us here about your new paper on alien philosophy, as well as your works of fiction, which I know personally have meant a lot to me over the years. I'm a big fan of the Second Apocalypse Saga. I loved Neuropath and Disciple of the Dog as well. So we want to welcome you to the show, and I believe Joe has the first question here related to on alien philosophy.
Well, actually, I mean, I guess we should start just by, Scott, is there anything you'd like to tell our audience about yourself? Just introduce yourself, and then second, we'll get to the meat of the paper.
I'm a farm boy who grew up in southwestern Ontario and ended up falling in love with Lord of the Rings and Conan the Barbarian at a preposterously young age and just never grew up.
What's your opinion on the Milius movie?
It has to be the one written by Oliver Stone, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Ernie.
All right, so we wanted to get into the idea of your paper about alien philosophy. Could you just start by, as succinctly as you can, explaining what your motive for writing this paper was and what your basic conclusions are?
Okay, so, I mean, I kind of backed into philosophy. My original degree program I took at university was languages and literature, and it quickly became apparent to me that I was barking up the wrong tree. And so the question for me was basically how to transition, you know, my literature degree into something more philosophical. So I did a critical theory graduate degree, and in that case, I found myself knee-deep in all these philosophical traditions, 10,000 different interpretations of the same bloody thing. I think the best way to put it is dismayed. There's just so much confusion. It seemed like there was so much obvious obfuscation. I sort of quickly came to the conclusion that something profoundly wrong lay at the heart of traditional philosophy. And I just endeavored to be as honest and as ruthlessly skeptical as I could and try to figure out what that something wrong was. And On Alien Philosophy is basically the answer I've been able to come up with after about 20 years of studying and researching the topic, both in formal university contexts and on my own. And the idea, in a nutshell, is simply that we human beings simply did not evolve the capacity to reflect upon ourselves and our experience in any way, shape, or form that would allow us to answer theoretical questions regarding, you know, our experience. And when you really look at, you know, the question empirically in terms of cognitive neuroscience, for instance, and you see the way in which the brain constantly winnows information, constantly just selects a little bit of information from this process, a little information from that process, a little information from that process, you discover that the brain really is a giant bottleneck machine that is bent on selecting only what it needs. And On Alien Philosophy gives us a sort of picture of how we can understand that bottleneck machine such that it explains the morass of traditional philosophy of mind, our, you know, epical inability to figure out what the hell is going on inside of our own heads.
So in the paper, you make this distinction you just talked about, and you mentioned the idea of causal cognition versus heuristic cognition, right?
Yes.
Basically having a true understanding of the workings of things in a sort of deep information way versus having a, you know, on the fly, good enough understanding of things that gets us through everyday life, and that we're constantly using the latter to try to get at the former.
Yes.
A question I sort of wonder about is the former to me sounds like it is best executed in science. If we're trying to get causal cognition, it's when we, you know, put these tools on our inquiries, like scientific investigatory tools. And so does that leave any room for philosophy? Do you think that there is really any good philosophy to be done, or really should it just be science and everything outside of science is misapplying these heuristic models we have?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's definitely good philosophy. It's not the death of philosophy or theoretical speculation. I mean, there's no way to kill that. What for me it signals the end of is a certain type of philosophizing, which just happens to be the majority of philosophizing since the ancient Greeks, which is the idea of actually using heuristic cognition to try to get to the truth of heuristic cognition, using these shortcuts, these ways of actually avoiding knowledge of what's actually going on to solve problems as a means of getting at what's going on. And that's the philosophy that does that is the philosophy that's caused, you know, the bulk of our confusion today.
So how much of philosophy do you think is really just sort of backward looking ex post facto justification for our biases?
So the way I look at it is, you know, we have this capacity to metacognize. We have these ancestral abilities to basically pick things from the stream of experience and think about them and change our behavioral responses to the world on the basis of them. So think about Christmas with your relatives. You know, everyone has that family member who says something that you just, oh, you got to say something about it. But you know, if you do, it's going to ruin the whole night. And that's a great example of metacognition at work. You know, you're going to say something and then all of a sudden, whoop, wait a second, Scott, he's an asshole. Everyone knows he's an asshole. You don't need to tell everybody he's an asshole. If you tell everybody he's an asshole, then the whole night's ruined. right, your reproductive chances go flying out the window. That kind of sounds weird, doesn't it? But metacognition consists of a suite of practical tools. There's no way in the world that we evolved the metacognitive capacity we needed to do much more than a handful of practical things on the fly. And what philosophical reflection does is it basically takes those tools, repurposes them, and asks them to solve questions. There's just simply no way they could possibly solve them. But since we lack the ability to even see how little ability we have when it comes to metacognition, we have no sense of constraints or limits or whatever. And so we're confronted by this constant illusion of transparency. It seems like, yes, if only I think hard enough on this. Yes, if only I get my concepts arranged just right. Yes, if only I abandon the metaphysics of presence. Yes, if only I abandon the mirror of nature. On and on and on it goes. Everybody thinks that there's a way to use philosophical reflection to solve or the problem of human experience. It's all bunk.
So, Scott, in the paper you seem, and the way you just described it now, you definitely do seem to be trying to use this idea of imagining what alien philosophy looks like in order to reverse engineer our own human philosophy to better understand how we've arrived at our philosophical traditions. But I'm also just really interested in that speculative project, trying to literally imagine what an information processing organism orbiting a faraway star might think about. What hard problems would they encounter and how would they deal with them? And so I wonder if I could ask you just a few crazy kinds of questions that you don't even address in the paper.
Sure.
I started off thinking, like, you know, could you imagine that there would be an alien Hegel or an alien Wittgenstein? But these are kind of stupid questions, because I think these philosophers necessarily exist in a tradition, if you know what I mean. Like, they're reacting to all the philosophers that came before them. And so it's sort of silly to try to imagine if that history of philosophy would be recreated on other planets. But you can imagine other fields of philosophy and how they would be created. Mm-hmm. So I'm trying to think, like, what would alien meta-ethics look like? Is there anything that we could guess that would form the basis of how aliens would think about, you know, where their sense of right and wrong comes from?
Like, this is a really hard question to ask. I mean, part of the reason why I took so much care to underscore how plausibility of alien philosophy was all I was after, it's just simply because asking the question of alien philosophy earnestly, you know, is really difficult, simply because you got to assume so much convergence to just get off the ground. I mean, you have to that they use language in similar ways that we as we use language, for instance. So if you grant all that, if you grant convergence, as I call them in the paper, then I think meta-ethics would look like a giant mess, the way meta-ethics looks like in contemporary philosophy, just simply because, you know, when it comes to where we stand in these various super complicated systems that nature has us pinned in, we just have no access to the information we need. So what we really have to rely on is basically these blind guesses, you know, these simple heuristics, these little tricks that have, for whatever reason, preserved our ancestors in the past. Now, these tricks are just simply, they're literally invisible to us, even though they actually are the foundation of guiding our behavior through these super complicated natural environments. Now, any creature like a human is stuck in the exact same informational bind. They're stuck in a shallow information environment. They have these tools for picking out those handles, those features of the environment that actually help them get along or get on or get it on. but they actually have no way of isolating those simple heuristics as simple heuristics, no way of understanding where they stand in these superordinate systems. They're blind. And even worse, they're blind to their blindness. So every time these aliens would attempt to solve ethical questions, what is ethics? They're going to run into the same sets of illusions and problems that beset human philosophers. They're going to confuse the load landscape of ethical concepts as being a sort of autonomous system, as being all there is. They're going to think that they've actually solved something, even though all it takes is another person to ask the exact same question to arrive at, in some cases, radically different answer, following what seem to be very similar intuitions. So those two things, I think, are going to strand them as effectively as we've been stranded by metaethics.
I can imagine a skeptical objection to what you're saying, mm-hmm. That would be, okay, you're right that we are by nature shallow information consumers. We don't have deep knowledge about the world in order to get along in a natural setting. But you can definitely look at the way we've leveraged the weak tools we do have to do amazing things in, say, science and technology. Like, we can build an international space station, and that has nothing to do with our ground-level survival and reproduction. We've just managed to sort of bootstrap up some very basic survival tools into incredible products. Why would you think that we couldn't do the same thing with these hard problems like metaethics or natural philosophy or understanding the mind that we do with science and technology?
Well, I actually think that, a lot of the, norms of science, I actually see these things as technology. I see them as basically ways of turning, spinning tools out of our own brains, if you will. The idea isn't that we can't use heuristic cognition in novel ways. We quite literally evolved to do exactly what philosophers do, which is just simply try to, recast, repurpose our existing cognitive capacities in order to solve different kinds of problems. The problem with metaethics in particular is it doesn't really have anything to do with that process. So ethical thought has given us a lot of great ideas that we've been able to institutionalize in ways that have been tremendously, tremendously beneficial to humanity. But there's no way of actually, realizing that that's the case short of putting those tools into application. I would argue that the type of, norm tool making that humans have just done so fantastically well is actually a completely different process than the process that underwrites metaethical thought. Problems get solved when we actually discover a new simple heuristic that allows us to get along with each other in some way, shape, or form. But when you actually ask the fundamental nature of ethical thought, and you begin by looking at all these terms, all this norm talk, as referring to posits that actually play some role in some kind of economy, a transcendental economy, or a normative economy, or an anomalous economy, or an autonomous economy, outside of the circuit of nature, no one's gotten anywhere. No one's answered anything. All the dilemmas that confronted the ancient Greeks are still confronting modern philosophers today. And that's just simply because it constitutes an attempt to apply these simple heuristics, not to practical problems in the real world of politics and social interaction, but to the theoretical problem of ethics itself.
All right, now it's time to take a quick break, and when we come back, more of our conversation with R. Scott Baker.
Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astepro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astepro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astepro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astepro. Go to AstaproAllergy.com for a discount so you can get Astepro and go today. AstaproAllergy.com. Astepro and go. Use as directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at CedarPoint.com.
Are you still searching for your perfect place to call home? Well, now is the time to buy at Fisher Homes. If you're looking to move in before the end of 2024, May could be your last opportunity to start building your dream home and close before the year's end. If you're hoping to move in even sooner, Fisher Homes also has homes that are move-in ready and waiting for you, where you can start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with a new home advisor today at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. If you haven't heard of Visible, now you have. They're the wireless carrier that's making wireless visible. It's in the name. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. Having a one-line plan means you only need you to save. No estranged roommates, exes, cousins twice removed, or AI-powered humanoid robots needed. And because $25 a month really means $25 a month, you can call, text, stream, whatever, as much as you want without worrying about getting dinged at the end of the month.
No hidden fees, no surprises. No, really. It's like the old saying goes, you can't judge a book by its cover, but you can judge a company by its name. So spread the word. Tell all your friends there's a wireless company out there with transparency in their name, and they're called Visible. Start saving on wireless today at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
So maybe I've got one more, and then I'm going to throw back to Robert here. I wanted to go to a footnote in your paper about alien philosophy.
Sure.
You say that because we evolved in ecologies that didn't give us access to deep information, you know, we just knew enough to get along. You write, quote, my fear is that the provision of this information is likely to crash the effectiveness of many of our tools. A good deal of my fiction is devoted to exploring different crash scenarios. So I wondered if you could explain a little bit more what you mean about the idea of a crash scenario and how you explore this.
So when you understand that the bulk of our cognition is heuristic, that it really relies on these kinds of guesses that we're making, with the lack any sort of deep understanding of, you know, the actual physical structure of the environment around us, you realize that that guesswork depends upon an invariant background. So a perfect example would be AI, for instance. So human beings, we evolved to manage an unbelievable amount of complexity. We evolved to solve the most complicated systems that we know of in the universe, basically each other, without actually knowing the first thing about what's going on in brains or ecologies or what have you. So heuristics solve by taking things for granted in their environments. So that means the only cognition can properly function is if those things that it takes for granted actually obtain in its environments. So if you look at that last year, there was the first fatality ever attributed to a self-driving car. And I think it was a Tesla. And the unfortunate fellow was driving on an incline and a truck was crossing his path. He was watching Harry Potter on his dashboard. Oof. He had his autopilot on his car. Now, the autopilot actually read forward and the white truck crossed what was actually white sky. This is what they think happened. And as a result, the truck's trailer cued open space to the computer. And so the car just drove right underneath the truck trailer. That's exactly what happens when the environment doesn't cooperate with a heuristic problem-solving system. If that system cannot discriminate between white truck, white sky, then it just sees sky. And so that's actually a perfect example of a crash space, where you have a cognitive system that requires the environment to be a certain way in order to properly solve a problem. When the environment is changed or varies in a way that it cannot accommodate, then you literally have a car crash in that case. Now, that obtains as much for self-driving cars as it does for human social cognition. So my big fear with AI generally is that you and I evolved to solve each other over literally the history of life on this planet. We're enormously complicated, and yet we're so finely attuned to one another that we can make unbelievable predictions as to each other's behavior and reliability and so forth. Now, what happens when you take that ecology and you start injecting all these little artificial agencies that are literally designed to cue your heuristic social cognitive systems out of school, right, for some sort of commercial advantage? Now, all of a sudden, you find human beings using these systems that are exquisitely designed to make sense of other human beings. Now we're using these systems to make sense of machines that have literally been designed to empty our wallets or, you know, sway our votes or what have you. Now, that's a crash space. And it's a tremendously significant crash space. Because what it means is that human beings are going to be able to trust their social cognitive systems, that suite of simple heuristics we use to solve the monstrous complexity of each other, we're going to be able to trust that less and less and less moving forward, because the environment, the invariant background that it's adapted to solve no longer exists. So really what my big fear is that we're looking at the destruction of the human cognitive habitat, that all this stuff that people are celebrating, Mark Zuckerberg, even President Obama, really is the beginning of the end of the ability of human beings to make sense of each other, the world, themselves, what have you.
Now, Robert, I know some of these ideas come up in some questions you had about the fiction, right?
Oh, yes. At this point, I'd want to jump ahead to a question I had for later, but I think it ties in here. So your book, Neuropath, is a wonderfully scientifically disturbing thriller, a sort of near-future, neuroscientifically charged psychological thriller, for those who haven't read it. What you've just described here instantly made me think of the semantic apocalypse. Is that the same concept, or is that a related concept?
That's the same concept, yeah.
Okay.
That's the semantic apocalypse. I kind of see it as having two stages to it. I mean, the first stage is actually on alien philosophy. I mean, the first stage is just clearing away all these philosophical conceptions of meaning and coming to understand the practical nature of intentional cognition. And then the big problem with semantic apocalypse has to do with the slow degradation of the environments that intentional cognition requires in order to function reliably, right? And it's the death of meaning in every sense.
When you say the intentional environment there, you mean reasoning on the basis of inferring the intentions of others, sort of what Daniel Dennett would call the intentional stance?
I'm actually greatly enjoying Dennett's book right now, his latest book. There's no intentional stance in my position. There's no perspectives or anything like that. I mean, intentional cognition just simply means basically all the machinery in your brain that enables you to solve the behavior of other biological life in your vicinity to like incredibly rarefied extents, right? And when you look into, when you look at human behavior in particular. See, the problem with the intentional stance is that it's actually an attempt to use intentional cognition to theorize intentional cognition. And that's the big reason why Dennett has such a hard time actually selling his position to other philosophers of mind who want intentionality and meaning to be a thing, be something right. in the world. I share much of Dennett's view, but I don't see how the intentional stance has anything to do with the parts I share. Your original question had to do with just simply what I mean by intentional cognition. And once again, it's simply the machinery in our head. That's, you know, what gets taken out by a stroke. That's what gets, you know, pathologically attenuated in cases of autism. That's, you know, what gets degraded in dementia. You know, that's where the action is. And I think that's all we need to really get a theoretical grasp on what's going on with meaning.
In your second apocalypse saga, an alien race known as the Inkaroi play a crucial role. Did on-alien philosophy in part stem from trying to understand their perspective? And yes or no, how does one try to think like the people of emptiness?
How does one try to think like an Inkaroi? Wow. I've tried to actually get into their headspace on several occasions. I find it really difficult. I mean, the problem is that, you know, our own sort of experience of our own first person is so unbelievably specific to our biology and to our history that as soon as you try to actually think of an alien way of thought, it ceases to make sense. And I mean, on alien philosophy is tied to the Inkaroi, not so much as exploration. Okay, so the Inkaroi are not so much, you know, the object of on alien philosophy as they are kind of the cipher for the ultimate significance of alien philosophy. Because the ultimate significance of alien philosophy is that, you know, once we understand that thought is ultimately material, physical, and just simply part of all the natural processes going on in our environment, nothing ontologically extraordinary, then we realize that this boundary that we're just creeping up to and are getting ready to cross, where we have literally gained the ability to control physical processes at unbelievably small scales, cellular scales. At this point where our own biology is becoming technology, if on alien philosophy is right, then Inkaroi are one possible consequence of us crossing this boundary. So the Inkaroi could possibly be us in some respect, where, you know, given up on any sort of normative ideals of or truth or what have you, and have literally just simply collapsed into this biohedonism that is, to our moral sensibilities, absolutely horrific. And that's, for me, the Inkaroi have always kind of represented the ugly consequences of on alien philosophy, the fact that we are going to climb out of this dream that we've had of being exceptional in some way and discover that we are just simply material, and that we will just simply chase fitness indicators, you know, via our technology to the point where we become something that our present selves can only be horrified by.
Well, that's excellent. That's certainly a horrifying thought to think of ourselves as the Inkaroi.
So in imagining alien philosophy, you've got these convergians who are, you know, have some amount of sufficient convergent evolution with us. They're somewhat similar to how our information processing works, at least. Is there any reason to assume that even if conscious cognition exists in convergians, that it would feel the same to them as conscious cognition feels to us? I know that's kind of a strange question to ask because you can't even be sure that another person's, conssciousness exists or feels the same as yours. But we tend to assume that feeling like a human, you know, it feels sort of like one thing mostly. We could be wrong about that. But is it possible to imagine radically different subjectivities, not just radically different behavior throughout the universe?
I mean, I'd argue that it's not impossible to imagine. I think it's just a lot more complicated than people would give it credence. And I think all you have to do is look at the human case to see that that has to be the case. Just think of the difference between different philosophers in the phenomenological tradition, like Heidegger, Merleau-Ponty, Sartre, Husserl, Schutz, Gadamer. I mean, if you look at all these different philosophers and all the different interpretations they've given of the fundamental nature of experience, I mean, some cases they're similar. They certainly share similar commitments, but there's a wild variance in how human subjective experience is described. So given that we have difficulty even pinpointing what it's like to be a human, the notion of being able to understand what it's like to be an alien has got to be that much more difficult. And so one of the things I try to argue in that paper is that you really, even if you can't say what it would be like, what you could say is what kinds of information they'd have access to and what kinds of information they wouldn't have access to, mm-hmm. and what kinds of problems they potentially might into as the ability to see their own neglect structure, to understand what it was they're neglecting. So to give a strange answer to your question, I mean, I think you can say things about the shape of alien experience, even if you can't say much of anything about the quality of that experience.
Yeah, one possible idea I had here was I was wondering if you think it would make a difference in the evolution of an alien philosophy if it occurred in a species that subjectively just had much less of a self-world distinction than we have. You know, we think of ourselves mm-hmm. as in the universe rather than being the universe. But of course, we are the universe. The universe is in a small part embodied in us and in the brains mm-hmm. that generate our consciousness. We just don't feel that way. Yet there are, you know, there are meditative exercises. Like you can do meditation that's specifically aimed at trying to get you into that state of mind where you feel like you are the universe. You just are the world. You are experience. And I don't
wonder, that's an artifact, right? I mean,
right.
It's not an apprehension, it's an artifact.
Exactly. So I wonder if, you know, if you imagine an alien species that doesn't naturally possess this self-world distinction, that just feels that it is the universe, could we imagine it would generate a radically different type of ontology of the universe, of what it means to be, and all of the socially derived philosophy, the metaethics and everything like that?
Yeah, and I think this is, I mean, I think this is actually a fascinating question. I mean, I've cracked my skull open against it a couple times now. And I mean, what I think is the case, I think metacognition, it doesn't matter where you are in the universe. Metacognition is expensive. And if metacognition is expensive everywhere you go in the universe, it is going to be hard, very, very hard, for an alien species to intuit its own continuity with its own environment. So, I mean, they're going to be stuck relying on simple heuristics in some way, shape, or form. And if they don't develop the metacognitive capacity to be intuitively deduce, you know, the fractionate heuristic nature of their own metacognitive capacities, they're going to be duped the same way we've been duped into thinking that the information they're getting is sufficient to draw conclusions. Think about human philosophy, how strange it is. I mean, we've been asking the same bloody questions for thousands of years. Thousands of years. No answers. No answers. I mean, you know, really, that's madness, isn't it? Doing the exact same thing and expecting a different result.
Indeed.
I know each philosopher tweaks something along the way, and they think that tweak is going to give them a different result. But it really is, you know, a paradigm for madness if you think about philosophy in those terms. Traditional, intentional philosophy, reflection on the soul. I think that just simply follows from the biological expense of metacognition. So that you can have an alien species realize their continuity with nature, but there will be some point in their past where they assume the same kinds or similar kinds of exceptionalism as we have, where they think that they're actually something apart simply because they lack the metacognitive ability to actually cognize themselves as continuous with their environments. You see, I mean, think about choice, for instance. There's just nothing intuitively obvious than choice. But they're just physically impossible when you consider it in light of causal cognition. The reason we believe in choices is simply that we have no way of intuiting any causal provenance for anything that happens inside of our beings. And that'll be the case for any alien species whatsoever. So they're going to be blind to the causal provenance that holds them continuous with the greater circuit of nature. So, and I think, you know, that first move, the move that humans made, oh, well, we must be something apart from nature. We must be something exceptional, something outside, transcendent, anomalous, autonomous, what have you. I think that is going to be something any intelligent species working through the bugs of its metacognitive capacities is going to encounter.
Awesome. Now, as we've been talking about crash scenarios, alien philosophy, it's interesting to think back on the books of the Second Apocalypse saga, and you know, and see how this is utilized throughout the books, because you know, this fantasy series has been the playground for your ideas for so long here, and it's generally classified as fantasy. Yourself classified as fantasy. So I wanted to ask in advance of your recent AMA on Reddit, you stated, quote, "If God is dead, then fantasy is his grave." Can you expand on that for our audience?
Yes, sure. I mean, the AMA organizers, they give you a fact sheet, and the first thing the fact sheet recommends is that you come up with something jaunty and light to introduce your AMA. And I'm just such a contrarian. First thing that jumped in my head, and very serious at the same time. It's serious insofar as it makes a reference, of course, to Nietzsche's famous claim that God is dead, and that's usually taken as an emblem for basically the way in which Enlightenment reason collapses into nihilism. And so in that sense, that claim is very serious. If God is dead, then fantasy is his grave. If you see the death of God as the problem of nihilism, then fantasy actually becomes the greatest place in the world to try to understand what the role of nihilism in contemporary society is. Fantasy worlds because they resemble scriptural worlds. The more your world looks like Vedic India or biblical Israel or Homeric the more readily your world will be identified as fantasy. Why is that? Well, in all worlds, meaning is objective. Morality is objective. There's a fact of the matter when it comes to right or wrong. You know, intentions are objective. All these things have objective existence. And that's what cues them as being fantastic. Now, that's, for me, that's crazy. For me, that makes fantasy the canary in the coal mine. Fantasy is where we can actually see meaning die in our culture. We see all these worlds that science has rendered factually irrelevant, you know, recreated over and over and over again, like for the enjoyment and edification of millions, millions of readers worldwide. And that statement is just simply meant to encapsulate that we can look at fantasy not as a throwaway escapist, culturally retrograde mode of entertainment, you know, that's ideologically trammeled in how many ways. We can look at fantasy as actually the very cutting edge of where, you know, human thought and nihilism, you know, the fact of our own material nature come into conflict. Fantasy is the spark, you know, when that flint and that iron are struck.
So, Scott, if you see fantasy embodying some of the meaning structures that we used to get from mythology and religion, I wonder if you see a kind of parallelism in modern fantasy of the different types of meaning and ethical structures that you would get from different ancient mythologies. One thing that I think of is like the mythological world that has a virtue ethic versus the one that has a moral ethic. I don't know if you might consider this like Greek mythology versus Buddhism or something, where in one you have an ethic that's about being great, and in another one an ethic that's about being good. Do you see this paralleled in modern fantasy?
I mean, fantasy, like any other fictional platform in which to explore ideas, it just rips the windows out and kicks the doors down, right? I mean, you really can go almost any direction you want. Stephen Shaviro, who's a fantastic cultural critic who teaches out of Wayne State University, he has a book called Discognition, where he literally argues that fiction is or has become the primary platform for being able to explore philosophical ideas for this very reason, the fact that you can actually contrast the virtue ethics to a more authoritarian ethics, right? The fact that you can ask questions like, what is the meaning of life, without it just simply collapsing into a joke. Really what happens outside of fiction, it seems. I mean, either you think of the meaning of life, what part of the bookstore do you go to discover the meaning of life? You don't go to the science section, you don't go to the philosophy section, you go to the New Age cult section. Fiction gives you that freedom to actually show that, no, I don't care what your a priori intuitions tell you, we can actually build a plausible narrative as to, you know, what would come of the death of meaning, for instance. It just provides a platform that allows you to blow past all of these philosophical constraints and explore things without having to, you know, worry about being lectured by pendants, you know, on your ignorance regarding this or that.
All right, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to jump right back in to the conversation.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2.
Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
Are you still searching for your perfect place to call home? Well, now is the time to buy at Fisher Homes. If you're looking to move in before the end of 2024, May could be your last opportunity to start building your dream home and close before the year's end. If you're hoping to move in even sooner, Fisher Homes also has homes that are move-in ready and waiting for you, where you can start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with a new home advisor today at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. If you haven't heard of Visible, now you have. They're the wireless carrier that's making wireless visible. It's in the name. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. Having a one-line plan means you only need you to save. No estranged roommates, exes, cousins twice removed, or AI-powered humanoid robots needed. And because $25 a month really means $25 a month, you can call, text, stream, whatever, as much as you want without worrying about getting dinged at the end of the month.
No hidden fees, no surprises. No, really. It's like the old saying goes, you can't judge a book by its cover, but you can judge a company by its name. So spread the word. Tell all your friends there's a wireless company out there with transparency in their name, and they're called Visible. Start saving on wireless today at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Hey, this is Jody Sweetin from the podcast How Rude, Tanneritos. As a nostalgic voice from your past, I'm here to remind you that amongst the stressful and chaotic existence we live in 2024, you deserve to get away. It's time for a vacation, no matter when you're hearing this. And let me tell you how you'll get there. The 2024 Hyundai Santa Fe. Want to bring the family to the mountains with the Santa Fe's available H-Track all-wheel drive? Well, it's got standard third-row seating and available dual wireless charging pads for the kids who just want to stare at their phone and not talk to you. You know what I mean. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Now, Scott, you've mentioned that among other works, Frank Herbert's Dune influenced your fantasy fiction. What's your take on Frank's run of Dune books? And were there any lessons there that informed your own world building and approach to a multi-volume series?
Yeah, and this is a very good question. I mean, because it actually, my experience reading Dune, it probably is one of the, has had the biggest influence on my discipline writing these books over the past decade. So my experience reading Dune was I read Dune, blew me away, absolutely blew me away. And so what do I do? I go out and I buy Children of Dune, I go out and buy God Emperor and Dune Messiah, and I read them in order. And God Emperor Dune, okay. But he lost me on Dune and Messiah. And I could just feel that, I just had a feeling that he'd kind of lost focus, lost the spark that drove the original vision. And so for me, reading Dune was sort of a process of being disappointed in what I thought was his commitment to the vision. And so when I set out and started these books, I'll never forget. I mean, Darkness That Came Before had come out, I think it was 2004, 2003. And I found myself having lunch with one of my idols as a younger man anyways, Guy Kay. And we're in Greektown in Toronto, and he asked me about my next book, and I told him it was a sequel. And he said, well, how many sequels do you have planned? And I said, well, I think 9. and he literally said, the last thing, this is another multi-volume epic fantasy. And no, my heart did not sink to the through the bottom of my shoes. I said, no, I think that what the world really needs is a multi-volume epic fantasy that does not lose sight of its vision, guy. And so that's the thing. I mean, you know, I was a young writer writing The Prince of Nothing and The Warrior Prophet. I mean, I was teaching at the time, and The Thousandfold Thought even more so. I really felt the pressure to actually write those books inside of my delivery dates. And I think both those books actually suffer for it. And I think The Vision suffered for it. I still love the books, but I would love to rewrite them as well. Moving into The Aspect Emperor, I decided, no, I mean, that's a problem. You know, I committed to The Vision from the very beginning. And that means I just let The Vision call the shots. And so, you know, with The Judging Eye and The White Luck Warrior, and then, of course, the final volume of The Aspect Emperor, calving into two, that was just exactly what had happened. You know, rather than worry about what my agent would say or what my editors would say, and I hate to say it, my readers, I thought, you know what? Everyone will be better served if The Vision's better served, because really that's what people are signing on for. Right? They want to follow this story, one story, all the way through to the conclusion. They don't want it to turn into a different story. They don't want it to suffer because of my, you know, I mean, I spend 10,000 hours with these characters. I hate them at times. You know, readers spend, you know, a few dozen hours with them. And they don't get tired of them the way a writer does. And so really all along that experience reading Dune has really sort of informed my decision-making. You know, if I'm hating this character, I'll stop writing. I'm not going to force it, right? I know I love that character. I'm just tired of that character right now. I'm not going to invent a new character, right? Because I'd just be freshening things up for me. Right? My readers, they don't want a new character. They just want to see what happens to this character, this beloved character or hated character or what have you. And, yeah, so my whole MO kind of became one of sit back, let the story tell itself the way it needs to be told. And I think that's part of the reason why I just feel so supremely confident in these final two books. I know there's people who disagree. There always is, but I really feel like I accomplished that promise I made to Kay all those years back in Greektown.
Well, I really enjoyed the most recent one, and I'm looking forward very much so to the Unholy Consult coming out this summer. Correct?
Yes, yes, yeah. So hopefully you agree with me. Hopefully you think it works. So it's a risky series, right? I mean,
certainly
a lot of risks.
But I always feel it's a risky scenario reading one of your books, because I don't know to what extent you're going to damage my psyche a little bit, you know, or force me. So much fantasy takes one out of oneself, you know, and serves as at times just pure escapism. But but your work always manages to sort of do both at the same time. So I'm able to escape into a dark, rich, imagined world. But then also you're forcing me to ask at times troubling questions about myself and about humanity in general.
Yeah, that's the goal. I mean, that's just what you just said there. That's writer's gold. So, that's what I'm aiming for. What I'm always trying to do is to try to immerse and push out at the exact same time. It's tough. It doesn't work for a lot of readers. It's true.
Now, you've mentioned in interviews before how you might have written some aspects of Neuropath differently if you'd finished it after the birth of your daughter. Has becoming a father affected the arc of the Second Apocalypse Saga?
Well, I certainly hope not. I mean, with the Second Apocalypse Saga, the idea came to me when I was 17 years old, the basic narrative idea. And it's actually remarkably unchanged. I mean, given the fact that it's, you know, sort of soaked up so much of my education, basically, you know, all those years in university, you know, studying literature, and then all those years studying the history of philosophy, and then all these years now soaking up cognitive science. It's still that narrative which ends at the end of The Unholy Consult, is still the same. So I even dug out for a couple of the final scenes of The Unholy Consult, I even dug out material that I had written almost 20 years ago to rework, wow, to put into the end of the book. And that was really exciting for me. I mean, the fact that, you know, when you aim at a far, far away destination, and when the journey is as sort of fraught with reversals and misdirection as this journey has been for me, when you actually arrive at your destination, I sometimes wonder, this must be what a nuclear missile feels like when it actually hits its target. I mean, it just doesn't seem possible that you can actually arrive at the place you set out to arrive. And I really feel as though I've closed the deal when it comes to that first 17-year-old idea. So there's more to come. There's more to come yet. But
I'm interested in something you mentioned briefly in the paper, which is Susan Schneider's idea that if we encounter alien intelligence, it's less likely to be biological intelligence and more likely to be machine intelligence, or what you might call more broadly post-biological intelligence. Mm-hmm. So I assumed, based on the way you mentioned it, that you agree with that. Would you agree with that? And what do you think about that?
Oh yeah, yeah. No, I think the argument's pretty ironclad. I mean, if you just look at where we stand in terms of our ability to travel between the stars and where we stand in terms of our ability to manipulate our biology and basically offload cognition onto our, you know, machinic artifacts, I think it seems pretty clear that the transition from biology to post-biology is actually something that becomes more technically feasible earlier than interstellar travel.
Another question that comes to mind, and this might be just too specific, and I'm tugging at something that's supposed to remain mysterious. But there's a scene in, I believe it's The Judging Eye, where the characters are walking through the ruins of the non-men, and it's you do a wonderful job just explaining their artistic style, their use of sculpture, and I believe it's mentioned that the non-men cannot see paintings, one of the reasons they depend on sculpture. Can you elaborate on that at all, or is that meant to be sort of a mysterious cipher?
You always want to distinguish your various races and species that you create in speculative fiction. And this notion of non-men not being able to see two-dimensional visual representations is sort of just like a textural detail along those lines, but it actually does have a rationale. I mean, the idea is that, just think of the cavemen in Chauvet in France, drawing, you know, their charcoal stained fingers across the cave wall for the first time and realizing they can see a shape in that and experimenting, right? Turns out for humans, we can actually see horses and bison and figures of humans given very, very small amount of visual information. Finger covered in charcoal dragged across a cave wall is enough for us to be able to recognize a lion or a horse. Famous horses of Chauvet are a wonderful example of that. For non-men, their ability, you know, to cue recognition of scenes just simply requires a bit more information, and in particular requires depth information. So they can see representations the way we can. They just have difficulty with two-dimensional representations just simply because the amount of information that is given in a two-dimensional representation simply isn't enough to actually cue the cognitive systems involved in recognizing horses and tigers and what have you. So there's a kind of I mean, it's just one of many ways in which, you know, my blind brain theory has sort of, you know, nuanced the background and the landscape of the novels.
And the blind brain theory, I don't know if you want to elaborate here, but this is basically the idea, getting down to the idea that the brain cannot perceive itself, and that's one of the big stumbling blocks to understanding ourselves and our place in the world, right?
Yeah, exactly. It's just basically the description I gave earlier, this notion of metacognition being largely, if almost utterly blind as to the brain's own operations, and more importantly, being blind to that blindness, and so being convinced that it actually can see its own operations. And then that's the explanation for why, you know, we have this madness called philosophy, where we simply ask the same questions over and over again, assuming there's answers, and there never is.
I know in past interviews you've referred to the ending of Neuropath, which, no spoilers for anyone, but it's a particularly bleak ending in many ways, and you've said that you might have written that differently if you had written it after the birth of your daughter.
Yeah, I almost certainly would have written it differently. Almost certainly would have. It's a hard book to read. I mean. I had a fan, like, I don't recommend the book, actually. I've stopped recommending the book to people. I've had good friends email me, you know, they've waited a couple of years before reading the book, and they've read the book, and they basically said, I wish I hadn't read this book. I've been feeling depressed for weeks.
I found it a depressing but fulfilling read. I do occasionally recommend it to people who I think
you gave me a copy, Robert.
I know.
What are you
I gave
Joe
a copy of it. Now, speaking of parenthood and dark stories, I assume reading plays a big role in your household. What's the darkest children's book you've found yourself reading to your daughter? And is there a particular genre book you're looking forward to being able to read with her?
Well, I mean, I'm really looking forward to being able to read The Hobbit with her. I mean, The Hobbit was a watershed read for me. And the idea of actually being able to share that with my daughter makes me feel giddy. I mean, it's crazy. I probably put balloons and streamers up or something like that. But and it's a pretty dark book. But I mean, all the Brothers Grimm fairy tales, Mother Goose fairy tales. I mean, we have a couple collections, and I read them to my daughter, and my wife would prefer that I not read them, just simply because they're so strange and violent, right? I mean, Hansel and Gretel, like, holy moly, what a story that is.
Indeed.
And I worry that as a culture, we're really losing faith in our children's ability to deal with darkness and unsettling thoughts. And I actually think that that's a huge social problem moving forward.
I remember yearning for that kind of stuff when I was a kid. I remember when I was a little kid, I wanted more dark. I was like not satisfied with how dark and disturbing and weird the children's stories I was supplied with were.
Ask me what my favorite Bible story is.
What is your favorite Bible story?
Sodom and Gomorrah.
Oh, wow.
I mean, I just thought that was the coolest story ever. I mean, obviously, it's not a cool story at all.
Well, yeah, and plus they have these illustrations,
you know, Lot's,
right?
Daughters seducing him in the cave afterwards. I mean, it's a downright creepy story, but those are the kinds of things I liked. And, I mean, I grew up in a religious household. Those are the things that... caught my attention and held it.
All right, so one last question here, and this is just an idle curiosity here. So I've long wondered if Arang and Arox, the last living Inkaroi in your books, are they at all a wink at Kang and Kodos on The Simpsons? Not that they have anything to do with each other except the fact that they're pairs of aliens.
Yeah, no, they're not, but it's going to be pretty fucking hard to move forward. Thanks for that little piece of pollution there. I mean,
or maybe it just changes The Simpsons. It elevates The Simpsons rather than
as if Simpsons is the only immovable object in the universe, I think, at this point anyways. Yeah, it's funny. It's like I stopped reading message board banter about my books and stuff. And it's just simply to keep the slate clean. I just find, you know, people will mention something to you and it'll be like, hey, that's a great bloody idea. Actually better than the idea I had. And I mean, it may feel that way. My own ideas always feel old to me, right? I just try to shelter myself from that a bit, just so I don't get too much interference when it comes to following through an original vision that I went on and on about.
Oh, yeah, I can imagine where you definitely want to plow ahead as much as possible towards that original vision without polluting it in any way, you know, based on fan interaction.
Yeah, well, I mean, the big thing is it, like I say, you spend 10,000 hours with these characters and this narrative and stuff, and the tendency is to you make it Baroque, right? I mean, there's just so many ways in which an author's exhaustion with the project ends up creeping into that project. And so so much of it just comes down to being mindful of my own exhaustion. I mean, how I feel about my own material and, you know, making sure I'm in the right place while I'm working on the books so that the books actually express, you know, what it is I want them to.
Well, on that note, thanks again for chatting with us, for answering our questions. Your books are all available right now. All the books in the Second Apocalypse Saga, Disciple of the Dog, Neuropath, you know, For the Brave, I guess, based on our discussions of it here, and The Unholy Consult, the latest book in the Second Apocalypse Saga, coming out this summer.
This summer, yeah. And it's the culmination of what feels like a lifelong quest for me now. So basically adolescent narrative that I've managed to pursue through, you know, graduate degrees and job changes. And strangely enough, the world just keeps trying to make my horrific vision come true. So it feels like it's only become more relevant now than it was back at the turn of the millennium when I first got serious about publishing.
And if anyone out there wants to follow you, you're on social media, but also your blog, 3 Pound Brain, correct, is a great way to just sort of keep up with your regular ideas.
Place to pester me with questions and whatnot, or just simply shoot me an email. You'll find my email on my blog. But just Google 3 Pound Brain and Baker, and you'll find yourself at my profane doorstep soon enough.
All right. Thanks, Scott.
Thanks, Scott.
Thank you, guys.
So there you have it. Thanks again to R. Scott Baker for taking time out of his day to chat with us about alien philosophy and his dark fantasy works. It was really a treat for me to finally chat with R. Scott Baker, throw out a few questions here and there. I tried to limit my geeky questions in this interview, but I worked in one or two there. Again, the first 6 books in the Second Apocalypse Saga are out there, and the next one, The Unholy Consult, comes out July 11th from Overlook Press. If you want to learn more about R. Scott Baker and follow him, his blog, 3 Pound Brain, is rsbaker.wordpress.com. He's also online, rscottbaker.com. And if you want to follow him on Twitter, he is The Devil's Chirp. That's just one word, of course, The Devil's Chirp. And finally, I want to drive home again that one of the things that I really love about his work is that I'm able to, on one hand, escape into just this wonderful dark fantasy world with all of its magic and intrigue, all of it just so perfectly created for the reader. And then at the same time, he's throwing in all of these thought-provoking notions about human experience and identity, motivation and cognition that really, you know, challenges you and forces you to look hard into the mirror. And I wanted to just share one more quick quote from him. This is from his book, The Judging Eye, that's in the Second Apocalypse Saga. He says, "I remember asking a wise man once, why do men fear the dark? Because darkness, he told me, is ignorance made visible. And do men despise ignorance, I ask? No, he said, they prize it above all things, but only so long as it remains invisible." All right. And again, we'll throw all those links on the landing page for this episode at stufftoblowyourmind.com. And if you want to check out more of our work, that's where you'll also find it. You'll find blog posts. You'll find podcasts. You'll find videos, links out to our various social media accounts, such as Facebook, Twitter, Tumblr, Instagram. We are on all those things.
And if you want to make your ignorance visible to us, you can email us at blowthemind@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
There are some things that are too good to keep a secret. Like how your Amex Platinum card helps you have the perfect trip. I'd like to check into the Centurion Lounge. Or how it seems like you always get those hard-to-snag tables.
Ooh, yum.
And how you get the most out of select can't-miss events. With access to the Centurion Lounge, Resi Priority Notify, and Amex card member benefits at select events, you'll have to share. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/withAmex.
Are you still searching for your perfect place to call home? Well, now is the time to buy at Fisher Homes. If you're looking to move in before the end of 2024, May could be your last opportunity to start building your dream home and close before the year's end. If you're hoping to move in even sooner, Fisher Homes also has homes that are move-in ready and waiting for you, where you can start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with a new home advisor today at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home.
If a new house is on your wish list in the next 5 years, grow your savings faster and experience your dreams with an Ohio Homebuyer Plus account from Kemba Financial Credit Union. A savings account specifically designed to save for a new home where you can earn 7% APY, a $500 matching bonus, and a $1,500 mortgage closing cost credit. Learn more at Kemba.org. Offer expires March 31st, 2025. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. NMLS 292230. Equal housing lender. Federally insured by NCUA.